welcome back to your Hebrew Nation Morning Show, where Hebrews from all over the world gather to share and listen about the biblical roots of our faith. Sit back with your favorite morning brew and join the conversation. Lines are now open, so call 503-967-3001. 503-967-3001. His kingdom, his people, and your radio station.
Hey, good morning. Welcome to the Hebrew Nation Morning Show. You're on with the wise guys. What a beautiful day in the neighborhood. We are looking at record highs coming up here to Oregon with nice, warm, toasty weather. And looking forward to that, being a former Southern California boy. I kind of like the heat, but
it's finally coming. It's finally coming back. We had a couple weekends ago that were into the 90s, but we're finally getting that Northwest summer weather again.
Yep, it is beautiful. I'm loving every minute of it. Hey, we always like to talk to you guys right off the bat on what's new with the day and what is happening around the world. And, not that we have a whole lot of insight for it, but it is fascinating to kind of know what might have happened on days like this before, or even, what is kind of interesting, that maybe we don't normally see.
Mm-hmm.
So, hey, Aaron, I'm going to come back to you, dude. And what is, today's what, the 19th?
July 19th.
July 19th. There's got to be some good things in July 19th from the former world.
Yeah. In 1942, George Washington Carver began an experimental project with Henry Ford.
Henry Ford, the first guy to make the assembly line, not the greatest of individuals.
No.
He was a mason that I understand, and he was quite the... But the driver of people, I mean, not the...
Interesting as you use that word.
Yeah, right?
Driver of people.
You like that?
Right. I mean, it's so funny because you say Henry Ford, people are like, oh, yeah, he invented the car. No, he didn't invent the car. Oh, he invented the assembly line. No, he didn't invent the assembly line. He just utilized things that were there. Because he built a car and realized, well, hey, better put it together. We'll use the assembly line to build the car.
Yeah.
And he's the one who kind of really revolutionized mass producing vehicles.
Cars. Yeah. So who was he working with on this day?
George Washington Carver.
George Washington Carver.
Yeah. And let's see, what was it there? This experimental project. Let's see if I can see what this experimental project was. Let's see.
Maybe it was to rid baldness.
I don't know. That's a long article. But not a whole lot of ones today. Well, in 1879.
That's a long time ago.
That's a little while ago. Doc Holliday makes his first kill.
Doc Holliday. Who was that guy anyways? I mean.
Became a friend of Wyatt Earp and the Earp brothers in Tombstone.
Wow.
And became lawmen.
Not the most kindest of all lawmen, are they? I mean, they kind
No, because it was Old West, But they were laying down law because there was a lot of lawlessness at that time. And it was like, okay, we got to crack down here and follow this and make us a civilized society.
What do you guys think of that nowadays? I turned on the news quickly this morning and I was noticing that... in Chicago, as normal, there's more and more death and...
No, it's called peaceful protests.
Yeah, peaceful protests. A lot of shooting. They usually lose 40 people per weekend by shooting. And I guess a young cop, a young man in his early 30s was trying to break up an argument and he was shot. He's now paralyzed.
Mm.
So he didn't die, but he's paralyzed, and no one has said anything from the mayor's office, and the fiance's rather upset. And
well, isn't who's the mayor there?
Oh, that's
isn't that what's her name? The crazy lady,
Lightfoot, whatever it is. She's whatever.
She looks like she belongs in the Addams Family.
You think?
Every time I see her, it's like, whoa.
Like this hanky eyes and this look, these eyeballs that are bigger than her mouth.
It's like, whoa, I mean, hello.
Don't go there, guys.
Mayor Lightfoot.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it's, what do you do with that? It's just, it's such a tragedy. What do you guys think of the lawlessness that's going on within the U.S.? I mean, I was also talking to a group of police officers for my CPR classes that I do at times, and they were saying that they won't even consider going up to Portland, you know? I have another lady that I knew, she works on the reservations, and she was informing me that 3 years as a cop on a reservation equals 1 year outside of the reservation. The amount of fentanyl that's in there, the drug overdose, the suicides, the anger, the angst that's welling up within everybody. Seems like daily we hear of an enraged road driver that pulls over and pulls someone out of their car or shooting. What is going on with this lawlessness stuff?
Well, it's what Yahweh says. These things have to happen. So don't get distraught. Don't worry about it. I mean, you may, worry is the wrong word per se. You can be concerned if you're directly involved or even partially involved. It's different, but don't get too unglued about these things. They have to happen.
But will that happen? I mean, the natural human instinct would be to respond and go, you know, it's really messed up, and fear starts getting in, gets in.
If you can do something, if you can be constructive in your concern, in your thinking about the situation, how bad it is, that's one thing. But if all you're doing is woeing and gossiping about it, it's worthless information.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't do something constructive for the situation, don't worry about it.
So then doing, not being able to do something could also cause a great amount of angst.
Yeah.
If you know, we are told that Lot, when he lived in Sodom and Gomorrah, he was a righteous man, but he was just constantly in turmoil over what he saw.
Yeah.
Was that because he couldn't do anything? I mean, think about that for a minute. What happens to us if we're watching a world of lawlessness? We're watching government officials not obeying laws. We're watching people get away with certain things.
Mm-hmm.
We're watching injustices within the court system. We're watching people being forced to do things against their will. As you guys know, here in Oregon, every single medical personnel is required to take that vaccine, whether they like it or not, and they don't get a choice.
Right.
What does that do to the human spirit? And how do we work beyond it? Aaron, what do you think?
Well, it's not an easy thing because you have so much that's stacked against you. But that's the way the system has been set up intentionally to
cause angst.
Well, to not allow one individual to just have full control.
Mm.
But what has happened is that it's been manipulated in such a way that now the organization that is not one individual, has control, and that control has now been manipulated in a way to, they can do whatever they want, but we don't get to do whatever we want.
That happens within fascism and
right.
that sort of stuff, which
right.
is you have the people in control versus they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we have angst again that happens.
Right. And the way it's supposed to work, the way it was intended to work, is the control comes from the populace, the individual people of the state or mm-hmm. our country. They give the authority to the leaders by electing them and keeping them in office and stuff. But that's the whole system has gotten mixed up. And so when we sit back and we look around and go, oh, hey, this thing's out of control. Oh, I can't do anything. I'm just one person. I can't do anything. And so the system's kind of gotten, flipped in our minds. But what we need to realize is, no, we still have the power. We still have the control. Because if we all stood up and said, no, you guys are wrong. we're going to take you out of power one way or another, whether that's we just vote them out or you get into, you know, another civil war, basically, would be the extent of that.
Well, what does that take? I mean, when you look at the Bible, you look at American history, you look at this stuff, it's usually an event
mm-hmm.
or a person or a group of people that all of a sudden become zealous over something. They actually start to say, hey, this is wrong, and if I go back to text sort of thing, we're going to do something rather than just gossip about it, mull it over, let it angst on us. They actually become zealous.
So on that, another one that I scanned over because it was just like, okay, it's just another thing. 1884, Seneca Falls Convention begins. Now, I'm sure that doesn't mean anything to anybody.
No, what is that? Seneca Falls?
Seneca Falls, New York, was the first women's rights convention.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Wow.
And so because a bunch of women stood up and said, hey, we need to be recognized here because
as a person,
because that's what our this country is supposed to be about mm-hmm. is all of us are equal.
Mm-hmm.
And so they find these this group finally stood up. And look what we're at today. However, what's the math there, Jack, if you want to go there? But, you know, we're at a place now where, yeah, there pretty much is equal if the men wanted to stand up and fight for the equality back. But there's a joke. It's,
yeah.
Yeah, it just kind of slid right past there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, but your point, these women stood up and said, hey, we're getting treated like dirt here and ignored. They stood up. They were zealous over the fact of, hey, we should be equal. And now today they finally are. Well, it's years ago, but they are.
So here's the question I think we should probably go down a day for those of you that are listening. And if you want to write into us, you can do so at the number 3.
Wise guys.
At.
HebrewNation.net. That's the number 3.
Wise guys.
At.
HebrewNation.net. And what is zealousness? Okay. And can zealousness actually be good, or can it move to a negative thing? What examples are there in Scripture? We're going to go over some of those examples. We're also going to go through some definitions. How is zealousness acted out? And can it turn towards something negative? Like take, for instance, if we take the Women's Convention,
mm-hmm.
they wanted to be viewed as people.
Equal like men are.
We
yeah.
can own property. We can vote. We can do these things. Why are you guys ignoring us?
Mm-hmm.
And then we eventually moved to a direction where the zealousness of the women's movement has been to take men down. So rather right. than actually looking at unequalness, we're angry at men, period.
Mm-hmm.
And that can have a negative effect.
Oh, and that can have, it will have.
It will happen.
Yeah, because we're created to be a partnership, to be a union. And Yahweh does not want all men. Yahweh does not want all women. He wants men and women together working for the common good. And until we do that and do it well, we're going to fall way short.
Yeah. One of his commands was be fruitful and multiply,
yep.
right?
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to do that without each other.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's a funny one, you guys.
Oh, that's so funny.
Stop.
Oh, you haven't got that yet?
No. But it's really interesting because you guys all know I do the horse thing, right?
Yes.
Okay, so over the years, because we live in a society of humans,
mm-hmm.
all right, we have bred out in the horse world the stallion that's zealous, okay?
Okay.
Because he's too hard to handle.
Okay.
And so they keep inbreeding in the horse business.
A calmer horse.
A calmer, more reliant, okay. a more stable individual.
Mm-hmm.
But that horse, that stallion, that stud in a modern society, if we were to throw him out in the wild with a group of wild horses,
no, he'd die.
He'd be demolished.
Yeah.
Okay, because the head stallion's like in charge, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's going, who the heck are you? I'm taking you out.
Yeah. So they're kind of like the Black Stallion.
Yeah.
The original movie of the Black Stallion.
Right? I love the Black Stallion.
Yeah.
Had all that book series. Did you read the book series ever?
No.
Oh, no.
No, they're because there's a movie.
Might have been patterned after a book, but that didn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Aaron's going to watch
the movie. It's much easier.
But that stallion was uncontrollable, except
I mean,
for...
Top Gun. There was no book for Top Gun.
No. Stop. If there was, I might have read it. You know, but hey, zealousness. Do we take... What is zealousness for? Is it important? Can it cause us to live? Like the black stallion lived.
It doesn't cause you to live. It causes you to live with zeal, with purpose.
Mm.
You know, because, I mean, we can just go about our day-to-day lives and just mope along and do our stuff and do it relatively well, but you're not doing it with liveliness. You're not doing it with zealousness. You're just hanging loose. You're just... And Yahweh wants people who are committed to his way.
Can a surfer be jealous? What are you talking about?
I don't know.
You said hanging loose, man. So, no, I'm just kidding. Well,
so how do we... So
I
how,
guess you can apply that to a surfer.
So how do we know where to apply that zeal? Where is the proper place to place that zeal?
Thank you.
Yeah. I think zeal can be applied everywhere. It's not just. I mean,
okay. I have zeal for promoting abortion.
Well, if you want to go there, well, then there's nothing other than the fact that it's abortion. There's nothing wrong with doing anything with zeal. Abortion is wrong. So, regardless of how you're doing it, zealous or not, it's wrong. But it's like cleaning house. You can clean house slow but sure and get it done. You can clean house just lickety-split and just fast, get it all done nice and neat, and you minimize your time, and that's all right as well. So, and that's cleaning with zeal, you know.
You know, it's fascinating to me because there's an element here that you're talking about that's not necessarily the real message, but... There's a part of that message that I think is something for us to note. And that is, it's right or it's wrong. And when we go down, if we were to compare zeal to right and wrong, we also comparing zeal to dogma. Dogma is an unquestioned belief system, typically.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
And so, is dogma a platform on which to provide zeal? And how do you know when? Let's go over here a couple things just to get our focus. I'm looking at this description here. And Aaron, why don't you look up Isaiah 59:17 or Tuck, look it up. And I'm looking from a biblical point of view. Zeal can be defined as a focused desire, okay? Characterized by passion and commitment. So many times it's focused, we're going, okay? And it's, I have passion and commitment. The Bible often describes God and his followers as zealous.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know this or not, but the Old Testament, zeal is found 16 times.
16?
16 times. And being zealous is 6 times. Okay, 16 and 6 is what?
22.
20, yes, he does it without even thinking.
he's looking up a verse and reading it over, and a number just pops out.
In the New Testament, zeal is found 5 times. And zealousness in 7 times. Typically, the Hebrew and Greek words for zeal or zealous also carry an idea of jealousy, specifically God's jealousy for his people and his honor. Okay, so that's kind of what it wraps around.
Mm-hmm.
And we can apply that even to our jealousy. Do I have a jealousy for God? Do I have a zeal for God? Do I have a jealousy for my mate? Do I have a jealousy for my children? God is described many times as having zeal, all right?
Yeah.
And the Lord's zeal is the cause of providing a remnant for Israel many, many times. Do we have that text up?
Yeah. For he put on righteousness as a breastplate and a helmet of salvation upon his head, and he put on the garments of vengeance for clothing.
Interesting. How is that pronouncing zeal? Let's look around that text a little bit. But if I'm putting on garments. What are those garments?
Well,
for peacefulness?
For he put on righteousness as a breastplate. And it doesn't say that it was a breastplate, but he says as a breastplate.
As, right.
So this is a representation of it's in kind of a warfare situation. That's what it appears to me.
Yeah.
That's the way I take that, because that's where you wear a breastplate, you wear protection, and a helmet of salvation. A helmet of salvation protects your head, but it's a helmet of salvation. You know, and so exactly how that applies to us, we all have different viewpoints about what salvation is. And so salvation upon your head of the of his word, of, you know, it has to do with his word. And the thing that I'm not surprised at per se, but intrigued with, is the garments of vengeance for clothing.
That's zealousness.
Yeah. And so that's, you're going out of your way to do right and doing it his way, not your way, his way.
At the end of that verse, I have this, and wrapped himself with zeal as a mantle.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go back, because Scripture always has to take you back a couple of verses, and let's find out what the problem was. So if I go back in verse 15 and 16. Now the Lord saw, and it was displeasing in his sight, that there was no justice. Isn't that interesting?
So you're saying that this was Hillary Clinton?
I could be. He's seeing things that there's no justice. This is also brought up in the book of Yasher with Sodom and Gomorrah. One of the reasons why he destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah was there was no justice. There was no law. It was lawless.
Right.
Okay. So if I look in verse 16, and he saw that there was no man, no one to stand up, and was astonished that there was no one to intercede, then his own arm brought salvation to him, and his righteousness upheld him. Upheld who? That's the question we might have to ask. And then at the verse 17 that we're at, and he put on a righteousness like a breastplate, and a helmet of salvation on his head, and he put on garments of vengeance for clothing, and wrapped himself with zeal as a mantle. Who is this person that we're talking about?
Well, you can look at that a number of ways, as an individual or as a group of individuals. And Peshitta, that, and his righteousness sustained him, that's the end of verse 16, they have a note saying that that's Israel.
Could be Israel.
It could be Israel. Could be Yeshua. You know,
yeah. So if we look further in the text, we see that this. So they will fear. So this is what happens. So they will fear the name of the Lord from the west, and his glory from the rising of the sun. And he will come like a rushing stream, which the wind of the Lord drives, and a redeemer will come to Zion.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. In verse 18, according to their deeds, the deeds of those that are in justice or don't have justice, he will repay. Wrath to his adversaries, recompense to his enemies. To the coastlands he will make recompense. So you can see that how that would maybe define either to Israel or to the Messiah.
Yeah.
Interesting comments. But it's interesting that he's wrapped in zeal. Wow. So yeah. When do we put this on? And why does the Scripture talk about this? There's another text that we find. Let's go, and I think it's found in Ephesians, where you're going to find something similar. I think it's Ephesians 6. It's either
Roland.
Yes, sir.
Before you go any further, I think you need to look at that, the dressing yourself in zealousness.
Okay, do it.
What does that mean to you? I mean, when you wrap yourself in zealousness, that means you're doing it because it's right and proper and has to be done.
Keep that thought. We'll be right back. You carry me through the darkest night.
You're listening to Hebrew Nation Radio, a division of Torah to the nations.
Hey, good morning. Welcome back to the Hebrew Nation Morning Show. You're on with the wise guys, and we just left you on the break with Tuck talking to us about you've got to put a mantle on. You've got to clothe yourself. Tuck, I mean, why was that important to you? I mean, we're talking about zeal. We're talking about moving forward.
Well, I just remember when Yahweh told, I can't remember who it was specifically, but he was telling us as well, that vengeance is his.
Mm-hmm.
And yet here, he's talking about in verse 18 that he may seek, in verse 17 and 18, for he put on righteousness as a breastplate and helmet of salvation upon his head, and he put on the garments of vengeance for clothing, that he may seek vengeance upon those who hate him, and retribution to his adversaries, and to the islands he will render recompense.
Mm.
And so that shows me that Yahweh will use us for his work, even hard, tough, nasty work, and that has to be done. And in my opinion, vengeance is pretty stout. I mean, we should not be looking for vengeance ever. If Yahweh brings us into a situation to where it has to be done, that's different. But nonetheless, you should not relish in vengeance, in the seeking of vengeance. It's Yahweh's work.
Because, yeah, he says, I'm vengeance.
Yeah.
Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord,
exactly.
which is a script.
But he will use us in his will.
In that process.
For all things in that process.
Interesting. Yeah,
so. See, my question there was, whose vengeance are you putting on? Is it your personal vengeance? Or is it his?
I think it would be his.
And see, and that's why in this situation it would be right.
Yeah.
Whereas if I put on my vengeance, I mean, sometimes when somebody comes across my path and offends me, I'll just make something up, and offends me, you know, I get all bent out of shape, and the thing I want to do is I want to go out and punch him in the face.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, that's not the right kind of vengeance to have. You know, that's that man spirit. And it's like, no, I gotta respond in a way that would be Yeshua-like, because probably what the case is, that person's hurt and they're lashing out. And so me just going out and punching him in the face is not going to be the right response. I need to go and see, hey, What's going on with you, man? You know,
one of the comments that came in here is that I just got on a text was that one of the points of warfare, one of the things you need in warfare is not just the things that you put on, but they highlighted the zeal part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that within Torah that the Lord Lord told Moses. Moses related that to the group that if you don't have zeal, if you're afraid, you're supposed to stay home.
Yeah.
Don't go into warfare.
Right. Because you will be a hindrance to the whole body.
Yeah. Right.
Or if you're newly married.
Yeah.
You know, so you stay home, which I just had a thought of. That's why some guys wanted to have multiple wives. Oh, new war, new wife.
He's been newly married for 15 years.
Yeah, I have no zeal.
This is weird. A guy meets a guy right before we go into war every time. Wow.
When I look at the word zeal, it tells us this, enthusiastic devotion to a cause. Think about that for a minute. Enthusiastic devotion or a goal or passion. A passionate ardor is the pursuit of anything, intense interest or endeavor, eagerness to accomplish or obtain some object. So zealness is it's definitely an attitude.
Yeah.
Okay.
The thing I like in the, I was looking up the Oxford, and it said great energy. So I liked that descriptor. It's that energy that drives you for whatever the thing is.
If we take that text that was given to us in Isaiah, do you know where else that text is repeated? There's a similar text. Let's go to Ephesians 6.
I'm going to guess if the answer is Ephesians 6.
Yeah.
Whoa, that's pretty good, Aaron.
Yeah.
I've never been accused of being a Well, I don't know where I was going with that.
It goes like this. Take up the full armor of God that you may be able to resist in the evil day.
Okay.
Okay, so let's put that on for a minute. We're going to put on this armor so we can do what?
Resist.
Resist what the evil day, having done everything to stand firm. So stand firm, therefore, having girded up your loins with truth and having put on the breastplate of righteousness. There mm-hmm. it is again.
Yep.
Okay, same thing. And having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace, in addition to all, taking up the shield of faith, with which you'll be able to extinguish all the flaming missiles of the evil one.
Mm.
Wow. And take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. Now, that describes what we put on again.
Yeah.
But I want you to see what's in verse 18, because this kind of lines itself up with that zealness or the mantle of zealness. So it says to this, with all prayer and petition, pray at all times in the Spirit.
Okay.
Okay, so does it say pray some of the time?
No, it's all.
It's just pray all the times in the Spirit.
Well, see, there's a whole thing on that, pray in all time.
You think?
Because, I mean, I remember, you know, shoot, in Sabbath school, talking about that. Well, how do you pray all the time? Well, the small mind that we had at that time, at that age, we're thinking pray as, well, I'm kneeling down and I'm talking to God actively at that moment.
Right.
Is that's the only kind of prayer there is. That's with the limited mind, right?
Yeah.
But it's not just that.
No. Let's take the text just a little bit further to give us a fuller understanding and see where zeal falls into place with it. Pray at all times in the Spirit with this in view. Be on the alert with all perseverance and petition for all the saints. There's a whole lot of alls going on in this verse.
Yeah.
Is that zealness? So if we were to go back to the definition of what we had on zealness. We have passion, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have this whole concept. Let's see if I can pull this thing up again. I just put it down. Enthusiastic devotion.
Yeah.
Okay, so if prayer is fighting in the Spirit. Is that enthusiastic? Yeah, that's enthusiastic devotion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A devotion to fight this battle. These are spiritual battles.
Yeah.
Because if we go back up to verse 12, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness. We're wrestling in the spiritual realms.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys are listening to that right now as you listen to this podcast, but many times we seem to always want to wrestle in the physical world.
Yeah.
But there's another world. The spiritual world, are you wrestling with enthusiasm through prayer in the Spirit 24/7? And what does it take to get that enthusiastic or to have that much passion and zeal?
See, the real life application I had to kind of think about the, pray without ceasing kind of idea is, Roland, you're a married guy. And have been for some time, so you're fairly decent at it at this point, or at least fairly experienced at it, maybe. Maybe I'll put it that way.
Stop! Is that a compliment, or was that I don't know.
you have plenty of experience, right?
Oh, thank you. Okay.
At doing marriage.
Uh-huh.
When you were with your wife, you're there, you're talking with her, you're hanging out with her, you're doing whatever activity with her.
Yeah.
But when you are away, when she's working, when you're working, whatever, you're not in the same space with her,
mm-hmm.
Are you still married?
Yes.
Are you still doing things that are honoring to her?
Yes. I'm either doing the dishes or doing some other chore for her or thinking about her.
Right. You know, because she's always a part of your life at that point,
yes.
And you're not going to go do something that's going to go against what you two have decided as part of what your marriage is.
Right.
Unless we end up being stupid, which we're humans and we do that too. But
thanks for including yourself in this description. You said we.
Yes. It's the same correlation.
Yeah.
We need to have that same kind of idea with our relationship with Yahweh. And so that's what that prayer still is. You know, if I go out and I start shooting up one of these places in, you know, I don't know, I'm going to pick a random place, Chicago. Mm-hmm. And that's not, you know, unceasing prayer.
Yeah.
Because that's going against what Yahweh wants.
Interesting.
So it's how you live out your life. It's not just that active talking with him.
So in the spirit to you means even when we aren't seeing something right in front of us, it's something outside of us.
We're just living out the lifestyle that he wants us to live out.
Yeah.
And being that example.
Yeah, see, I almost see the spirit working in the spirit is even in the heavenlies. You know, we have examples of Jacob seeing the portal of heaven and a ladder coming down and seeing how angels ascend and descend. I mean, what a vision he received. We also know that too, that prophets in the day of old, before Samuel, they had a name for prophets. It was called a seer.
Mm-hmm.
A seer would actually look into the heavenlies and to actually understand or to receive visions and dreams from Yahweh and to move forward with them. That's interesting to me.
Yeah.
Can we still have that same ability? We found it in the book of John that the Messiah told his disciples, if you follow me, you'll do even greater things than me.
Mm-hmm.
So if Jesus, Yeshua, was in the Spirit, being with his Father, doing great things, listening to his Father, being told what to do from his Father,
mm-hmm.
being told who to heal from his Father, then if we were zealous for that focus in the Spirit, praying at all times, would we have that same capability to listen to the Father and to know the direction we're to walk? I know it seems a little bit out there, but why not? If the apostles, look at the stories of the apostles, they were able to even hand off a handkerchief and someone would be healed. Their shadow would fall on someone.
Right.
And they would be healed. How? I mean, how does that happen? That's definitely not in the physical realm.
Right.
So we sometimes have to think beyond this. Do I have enthusiastic devotion? Or is my goal to pray in the heavenlies? Because according to this text, I'm to put these things on, all on. Why? With all prayer and petition, to pray at all times in the Spirit. That's not in the physical realm. That's in the spiritual realm.
You know, I mentioned over the break Desmond Doss, and I think that still applies to what you're saying right there. If any of you are familiar with the movie Hacksaw Ridge, it was about the first real conscientious objector, and he never picked up a weapon, even in the basic training when they said, okay, here's your rifle, you're going to always have this rifle, we're going to teach you how to have it. He's like, he wouldn't pick it up. They put him in the brig and said, you know, we're going to kick you out. We're going to put you in jail because you're not following the orders. And he's like, nope, I just can't do it. I'm a medic. I'm going to be, I'm not going to kill people. I'm going to try to help people. Well, he was in this massive, massive fight, on Hacksaw Ridge and just helping guys off the ridge all night long. I don't remember how many it was, but it was a ridiculous number that this one little tiny guy saved over that. And then they found him, they brought him back, and they went to go invade this ridge again, and nobody moved until Desmond Doss was done praying, because they saw what that did for him. They saw how he lived his life out, and they're like, okay, we're going to follow this guy over here. this little tiny private over here. We're waiting for him because there's something different going on there. And he was living out a very zealous life, and they're like, okay, we're following that.
Not only was his zealousness for prayer, but he had made a decision to follow the commandments of Yah and to respect the holiness of the Sabbath day. That was part of his zealousness.
Yeah.
And then when he goes ahead and gets up there, he has this zeal to bring people off the mountain. I can't imagine. And I think if you were a soldier in his camp, your comment might be, or at least mine would be, there's no way that that little dude could have taken off that many guys off of that mountain. His God must be pretty amazing, because I think that's the only thing that made that happen.
Yeah.
Because there's no way that guy could do that. I can't do that. He can't do that.
I mean, because even in the movie, they said, I mean, and there was no denying it.
Yeah.
Because all the guys were saying, they didn't know who was dropping these people down. They couldn't see who it was. And so they finally asked, well, who's up there? Who's doing this? Doss.
Doss.
Wait, Doss saved you?
Duh.
Yep. What about you? Doss. And everybody was saying Doss had done this. They're like, oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, wow,
we can't deny that, because that's what the guys are saying. That's who we saw do it, to saved me.
You know, at the top, one of the things that I loved about that film, because it relates to our study here this morning, as Doss was putting one person over, and then he would look at his hands, they're getting ripped up.
Yeah.
His body's tired. He can't move. And he looks up to the heavens. He says, just one more. Help me, Father, with one more.
Yeah.
Try and just get one more. And he's in this idea of rescuing people in the physical, I think is so parallel to rescuing people even in the spiritual. Because if we actually had this zealousness to pray to the Father and go, help me save one more, just one more. Can you shed your light into this other person's life just one more time? Here's a text for you that comes up. Because I want us to understand these greater works things and what spiritual is and what looking into heavens might actually look like. Yeshua answered, this is found in John 5:19. Yeshua answered and was saying to them, truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself unless it is something he sees the Father doing.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever the Father does, these things the Son also does in the same way. So again, the heavenlies weren't down on the earth. The heavenlies are up above him.
Right.
Yeshua is seen into heaven.
Mm-hmm.
He also has given us the command that whoever believes will do greater things than me. So here this is again. Can I see, and how do I see? And I think it's wound up in this verse, if I pray at all times in the Spirit. Remember, the Spirit was given to us to intercede for us.
Right.
It even tells us this, that, you know, as we go into prayer, if we don't know what to say, even the deepest groanings are relayed to the Father in the Spirit.
Yeah.
This is amazing stuff. So I wonder what, in our zealousness, do we consider not only the physical world, but do we consider spiritual warfare, which is what's described to us by Paul in Ephesians? For we wrestle not against flesh and blood. We wrestle against spiritual forces, dark forces. That tells us we're putting these things on to fight in the spiritual realm.
Right, but In that sense, are we doing the battle, or are we just stepping into the place and he's fighting it for us?
That's a great question.
And
even comment. I mean, what happened in the Old Testament? What did Yahweh always tell Israel? Let me fight the battle. So what good is Israel then? What good are we if he's doing the battle? Maybe that's what we should be asking.
And see, and I've always thought that and I've said this many times, of he can do whatever he wants. He created the earth.
Right.
Know? Just like, okay, done. There it is, right?
Right.
But he gives us the opportunity to be in part with his plan. We can't go out and save a life. But he gives us the opportunity to be a part of the saving of the life. And so it's for us still. And so we can choose to step into that opportunity to be a part of the opportunity of what he's doing anyway. No matter what, that thing's going to be done. But he gives us the opportunity to be a part of it.
Oh, wow. Would that give me more zeal?
I would think so. Because we know we've read the book, we know what happens in the end.
Yeah.
And so we just get to, okay, I'm going to jump in the boat. I know where the boat's going. I get to jump in the boat and be a part of it.
Yeah. If I'm a part of something, I truly believe my zeal is developed.
Yeah.
Is this the reason why we're seeing such great division right now? I think it's one of the reasons in the U.S. and around the world.
Mm-hmm.
We actually get to see the works of the adversary and the works of the Redeemer. It's mm-hmm. becoming very clear. I was just watching a congressional hearing the other day. Is
no wonder you haven't been sleeping.
Oh gosh, it's so bad. And the person that was for pro-choice or killing babies,
mm-hmm.
they would yell back at the congressmen or the senators that were asking them questions, and they wouldn't think anything outside the box other than, this is my body. This is what I'll do with it. You leave me alone. And it's all about me. And these are professors.
Yeah.
That seem to not be able to put any words to play. And then you would see the person that's pro-choice, calm, quietly presenting facts.
Pro-life, you mean?
Yeah, pro-life. They would be calm, quietly presenting facts. They would even be sincere in their belief to the point of quiet tears.
Mm-hmm.
About babies being killed just before birth.
Right.
Or the down in California now that they're allowed to let that baby die 28 days outside of the womb.
Mm.
Okay? Unbelievable. But the difference is stark.
Yeah.
Would this help us create zeal? So not only does the Lord let us work in the heavenly places, but in the physical places, and it's for our own good to develop zeal,
yeah.
to actually see things in the physical world in order to take us to the spiritual world. Because if I see these things happening physically, then I know I have to be thinking spiritually.
Yeah.
Again, what's another great example? What went into battle many times with the Israelites? I mean, things that we think that would be ridiculous.
Praise and worship teams.
Yeah. Yep. That's ridiculous.
Let's send the band in first.
Yes.
Yes. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to your Hebrew Nation Morning Show, where Hebrews from all over the world gather to share and listen about the biblical roots of our faith. Sit back with your favorite morning brew and join the conversation. Lines are now open, so call 503-967-3001. 503-967-3001.
Hey, good morning. Welcome back to the Hebrew Nation Morning Show. You're on with the wise guys. We're talking about zealousness. What is it? Where does it come from? Are we called to do it? What happens if you lose your zealousness? That's a bummer.
You got to go to Lost and Found.
Yeah, right. You know, during the break, Tuck, I found this text, okay, because you were caught up into the mantle of rapping. So we were looking at what was that? Isaiah 59, 17.
Wait, Tuck was rapping?
Yeah, right.
No, that's the term he used.
We were comparing a text found in Isaiah 59, 17, about putting on the breastplate of righteousness and all that kind of stuff. And then we compared that to the spiritual realms talked about in Ephesians 6, fighting within the spirit. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we have, I mean, you have to admit, I mean, almost everything in scripture is both physical and spiritual, but we were drawn to the idea in Isaiah 59 that we were supposed to put this cloak on.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And to wrap ourselves in it. I found another text that has that. Tuck, you want to hear it?
Sure.
Yeah, thanks for saying yes.
Sure. Okay,
would you have still gone on if you would have said,
yeah.
I'm okay.
Yeah.
No.
This is found in Acts 12, 7 to 10. All right? And this is interesting here, too, because many times we might ask ourselves, is it even possible to work within the spiritual realms? Is it possible to actually work with an angel? Look what happens here. And behold, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared, and light shone in the cell. And he struck Peter's side and woke him up, saying, okay, so Peter has been put in prison because of proclaiming the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And an angel of the Lord suddenly comes upon him and...
And the light didn't wake him up.
Right, so he strikes him.
Yeah.
Wake up, dude! And he's saying this, get up quickly. And Peter's chains fell off his hands, and the angel said to him, gird yourself and put on your sandals. According to the feet in Ephesians, this means having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. So let's get on your sandals could be gird yourself and put on your sandals. Well, if we also know that to gird yourself is to start at the beginning, putting on the full armor of God. Stand firm, having girded your loins with truth.
Mm-hmm.
So let's break this down. Gird yourself with truth and put on your sandals of peace for the gospel. We could put that in there for fun. Not that I'm being overly scholarly about it, but the angel did use these words, gird yourself and put on your sandals. And so Peter did. And then Peter says to him, and he says to Peter, wrap your cloak around you and follow me. Oh my word.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
So it's all of that same thing again.
It's that same thing again of zealousness. Don't lose your zeal, Peter. Let's mm-hmm. go.
Yeah.
You know, it's, how many times has that happened to us? Maybe you belong to a fellowship, or maybe you belong to a church, or maybe you belong to a Bible study. Maybe you are struggling on your own to follow God, and all of a sudden you lose your zealousness, lose your zeal.
Yeah.
And you get thrown into prison, and that prison kind of confines you.
Well, it could be a metaphorical prison even.
Yes! That's what I'm saying! We're in our own little space. Could you pray? I think you can, for the Lord to revamp your zeal. In this particular case, Peter not only gets to understand the physical arena, but he gets to see and work with an angel, which is in the spiritual world.
Right.
Wouldn't that pump you up?
Maybe, I guess. It's probably.
How does your verse 9 read? Because mine gives pause.
Acts 12, 7 to 10.
Verse 9.
Let's see if I have it on here because those are in that. Let me look up another thing here. Hold on. You can hear my pages turning because I just closed it.
So what do you, Tuck, when you say yours gives pause, what do you mean?
It makes me, it's food for thought. And he went out and followed the angel, not knowing that what was done by the angel was true, but thought he saw a vision.
So he wasn't sure if it was that if he was dreaming or if this was actually happening.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. So that's why he's saying these things.
Why not? I mean, I would think most of us doubt a lot of things.
Yeah.
And why wouldn't Peter? That can't be true. And in verse 9, and he went out and continued to follow. And he did not know that what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision.
Yeah.
I think I love that. That's like the humanness of all of us. This can't be real.
Yeah. But yet, even if it would, even if his brain was like, okay, I don't know if this is real or not, he still made the choice to go do it.
Yeah.
Even in what he thought might be a dream, he still went to go do it.
The thing that I appreciate was the fact that Yahweh saw fit to include that wonderment in Peter's heart,
mm-hmm.
that he would say that out loud.
Yeah.
And give us, it gives me pause to think, well, he's not any different, or I'm not any different, because I'm having the same questions myself, that kind of a deal.
Yeah.
And that's what I love you talking. I mean, because that's what it feels like. Yeah. I mean, this can't be real, but I'm outside the cell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't have chains on my hands anymore.
How did that happen?
They just kind of fell off, That was pretty marvelous.
That is more than marvelous.
Yeah.
Where are we?
In Acts 12, but we're outside of Silverton proper at Aaron's place in his garage.
Do you have the coordinates as well?
No, I do not. I know how to get here. I can take you there, but can't tell you what the address is.
There's a place in Silverton here. What is it? It's near one of the streets on the main street that it tells us where we are on the equator.
45th parallel.
Oh, yeah, I knew that.
Right here in Silverton.
Yeah. Yep.
Isn't that weird?
45th parallel. Halfway between the North Pole and the equator.
So here we are thinking about zealousness.
If you believe in the globe theory.
Yeah, right. You don't believe in the globe theory anymore?
I don't want to get caught
up. There's interesting aspects to both of that.
There really is.
And it has caused me to ponder, to say the least.
Well, one that, here we're going on a rabbit trail.
Yes, but,
yeah, big one. is when it comes to when the scripture says four corners of the earth.
Yeah, it does.
If it is a globe, what is that? What is meant by four corners at that point?
The whole issue there is that
the Hebrew
language is full of idioms.
Yeah.
And look at what idiom means in the dictionary.
Yeah, it almost sounds like an idiot.
Yeah. some people might apply, but...
Well, you said it.
Yeah. But an idiom is a play on words, if you will. Uh-huh. To help you understand a concept better.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so,
go ahead.
No, and that's where the four corners of the earth, he uses that phrase to cover the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like for us, and looking at the globe as a sphere, because that's what it is. I mean, if the globe is the way we think it is, well, then it's spherical. It's a circular organization. And so it's hard for us to grasp everywhere on a globe. Whereas if you have a box, you have a left edge, you have a right edge. You have an upper edge, you have a lower edge.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at the four corners gives us a greater ability to get that concept of the whole thing.
So let's look at this thing from another point of view since we're talking about zealousness, okay? If you notice, we have two discussions that are starting to happen because we hit a rabbit all of a sudden, right?
Hit a rabbit. We
just fell into the rabbit hole.
Yeah, you were chasing it down and killing the thing.
Yeah, that's right. Throttling the son of a gun.
I'm glad you said that rather than the other word I thought they might say.
No.
I saw Rollins' eyes get real big, like, oh, here we go.
zealousness can many times be tied into dogma.
Yeah.
Take, for instance, dogma can be a belief system that we hold.
It's a mama dog.
It's a mama dog.
Dogma.
And yeah, you ever seen a dog, you know, a mama dog get mad? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Any mama animal.
Any mama animal. So when does this happen? When your truth, when you believe is what is absolutely correct, is questioned.
Mm-hmm.
And we get zealous for our absolute or our dogma. Let me read this here to you for a minute. The definition of dogma is a doctrine relating to matters such as morality and faith set forth in an authoritative manner by a religion. It's a principal statement of ideas or a group of such principles when considered to be authoritative or accepted uncritically or without question. So dogma would be something that's accepted without question. In fact, we have it here, and I found this again from the dictionary's point of view. Dogma is defined as a belief or set of beliefs that is accepted by the members of a group without being questioned or doubted. In Christianity, dogma is the body of biblical doctrines proclaimed and accepted by a particular religion.
Mm-hmm.
So we have dogmatic beliefs from Baptists, from Lutherans, from Mormons. In science, we have dogmatic beliefs, sphere versus flat.
Mm-hmm.
We have dogmatic beliefs about creation versus
evolution.
Those are things that people will say, you can't question my beliefs. This is what I found to be true. How does dogma relate to zealousness? Does it enhance or interfere?
Yes.
It could do both.
Mm-hmm, I think so.
It could.
See, and I think that's why there's such the importance in having a guide stone.
Okay.
You see what I did there?
Yeah. I saw what you did there. You slipped in another squirrel. No, but it's a good squirrel.
Yeah. Because going back to our history, today. Is the anniversary of the finding of the Rosetta Stone.
Wow.
In 1799.
Wow.
Now, so for those who are not familiar with what the Rosetta Stone is, it's not the software that teaches you how to speak other languages. They got the name from the capital T, the Rosetta Stone. It's a misshapen tablet that contained fragments of passages written in three different scripts, Greek, Egyptian hieroglyphs, and Egyptian something else. I don't know how to say the word. But these three different written forms of language, words, three different ways to write. And it was the same passages in all three of these languages. Mm-hmm. And so that allowed for learning how to realize what old language and what words meant in the old are the same as the new. So that's was the guide stone for translating different things.
Wow.
Do you ever see the movie Stargate?
Yes.
They had these hieroglyphs, and it took them, they had to find a guide stone, if you will, to understand what each of the symbols meant to how we speak today.
Interesting.
So they can understand how all the stuff worked and use the little thing.
Isn't that amazing how Hollywood many times will give us a glimpse into the things that are not overly physical in the world, but also spiritual within the world?
Yeah.
But it's usually not always just, it's at times they'll sometimes show something from a Yah's perspective or what they think it might be, but most of the time it's from a human perspective or a adversarial perspective.
Yeah.
These are things I can offer you in my kingdom.
Right.
Satan speaking. But many times Satan, we've always found this to be true, that Satan always takes what is truth.
Mm-hmm.
and then
manipulates it a little bit.
Manipulates it.
Yeah.
To fit his agenda.
Yeah.
That to me is amazing.
Yeah. See, this goes back to what Tuck was saying about the way we read our scriptures today. We come up with four corners of the earth. Well, we have to go back to find out what the four corners of the earth, how that translated from the original language.
Yeah, what exactly was spoken in the original.
Right, yeah. Using the same kind of method that we learned from the Rosetta Stone.
So what kind of things can we be zealous about as a believer in scriptures and maybe not hold such dogmatic views? I would think that in most Christians and Hebrew fellowships, churches, you're going to find things that are very dogmatic. The life and death of Yeshua, the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
You would find the creation of the world. You'd find these are things that they set a strong belief on,
right,
and are zealous about.
Mm-hmm.
But would it be important for us to be zealous about either a flat earth or a round earth? Does that have anything to do with something we should be dogmatic about, or is this something that we should be dogmatic about?
Well, I mean, it all depends on your perspective on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we're supposed to believe what Scripture says is the truth, which we do,
mm-hmm,
and it talks about the earth in a way that does seem to translate into flat earth as we would think of it today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, four corners of the earth. There's other passages in there. Well, then we go, okay, so then I do have to be dogmatic about it's flat earth.
But is that an interpretation of what you view as in scripture?
See?
So you dogmatic.
But you have to, and that's where that study has to go in. You have to figure out, okay, what is it actually saying? To verify, you know,
yes,
is my thought correct?
So things we can stand on pretty easily. Thou shalt not kill.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty.
There you go. There you go.
Change it. It's not kill. It's murder.
Murder.
It's willingly kill.
Thou shalt not murder.
Two different things.
Thou shalt not steal.
Yeah.
Thou shalt mm-hmm not commit adultery.
Mm-hmm.
Can I be dogmatic with those?
Well,
sure.
Sure. Yeah. It is based on a good, solid
in-your-face statement.
Belief, yes.
Yeah. It's an in-your-face statement, mm-hmm, rather than a statement or a system of statements that we come to know through interpretation.
Right.
So take, for instance, if we were to take topics like flat or round earth, we'd have to get digging pretty hard into scripture itself, taking all the nuances,
right,
all the idioms, all the et cetera, and then develop a belief system that we could be zealous about.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some things that are hard, that are in your face.
Yeah.
Yeshua died and he raised.
Mm-hmm.
He says he's our redeemer. You know, these things are pretty blatant in front of you. What we just read here in Ephesians, it tells us to pray at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And it tells us to put things on. So I don't have to guess or try to bring in idioms or these different meanings. I just go forward.
Right.
So zealousness, many times, are we placing our zealousness on what we think we believe is true versus what we know to believe is true? And how do you define those? Many times I'll meet people within a congregation or fellowship, and they'll come up to me and go, "You are wrong." Okay? And I'm going, "Really? Can you show me where?" "Well, I just know."
Oh.
"Well, how
okay
do you know?" Okay?
You almost should say, "Well, I am right." "Well, how do you know?" "I just know."
Yeah. I know. What is that? <look like? laughs> I mean, you can't say that to someone.
"I am a woman."
No, you are not.
If you are, you are not a pretty one, Aaron. I tell you what. But then that's... I mean, we got to get to this thing. To be dogmatic, that is to have a strong set of beliefs about faith and doctrine, is often frowned upon in our pluralistic culture. I mean, mm-hmm, would you agree with that?
Yeah.
It's almost viewed as... What do they call that? Fundamentalism.
Oh, yes.
That's fundamentalism. You're a fundamental Christian.
You just can't get out of it. Yet believers in Messiah are commanded to be dogmatic. Let's look at this one. 2 Thessalonians 2:15. Brothers and sisters, stand firm and hold fast to the teachings, that means dogma, we passed on to you. This is 2 Thessalonians 2:15. Brothers and sisters, stand firm and hold fast to the teachings, the dogma. But what are those teachings that they passed on? They passed on the Torah, the statutes, and the Messiah being risen from the dead. So the teaching that Paul's talking about is the teachings of Messiah. The dogma we passed on to you, whether by word or by mouth or by letter. Now, interesting, if they're teaching the understandings of Messiah, what did Yeshua say in Matthew 5? You remember? Not one
jot or tittle?
Yes. Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law, until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and so teaches others shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. So again, we have to see that Paul would have supported the teachings of Yeshua because his message was Yeshua came and he died for us. Being dogmatic about Christianity or belief in the Messiah is seen by many as divisive, unloving, or close-minded. But what about those things that actually help our society?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if Yeshua said, or Yahweh says, my commands are what? Life, not death.
Right.
If you follow these, you'll have life.
Mm-hmm.
Is that unloving to preach the commandments of God and do so? Can we be zealous about it?
Is it unloving? No.
I'm looking at some other texts. It begins with this. This is, and everyone knows this, from John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. Would that be considered dogma? If I'm asking someone to believe in the Messiah, is that unloving? Or is
no.
it loving?
That'd be loving.
Because I want them to live, right?
Right.
Chris, our dogma is based on the love of Messiah who died on the cross out of the love for his people. And then it should manifest itself through us. So what kind of zealousness are we proclaiming? Are we proclaiming a zealousness for our understanding or for scriptural truth? And how do we get to that truth to make sure it's not just our understanding?
And see, and I think that is probably the key question is, you know, where's the motivation there? What is the driving factor? Is it my thing or is it Yahweh's thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hang on tight. We're going to be right back.
Listening to Hebrew Nation Radio, a division of Torah to the nation.
Are you still awake?
Barely.
I know, right?
Poor oxygen in the room.
Yeah. Right. Don't have any AC in here, and so you got to pump in some fresh air.
The life is being sucked out of us. As we're trying to figure out zealousness, dogmatic beliefs. And what do you do if you're the last man
standing.
Well, that must mean you're Tim Allen.
You'll never be the last man standing. You should take that to heart, because Yahweh, I can't imagine a place where there would only be one man left. Yahweh is our king. Yahweh is our ruler. And his way will win out. So you're not going to be by yourself.
I mean, I agree with that statement. But how many times do people, ourselves included, struggle with this idea, I'm the only one left who believes in the law. I'm the only one left who believes in mercy. I'm the only one left who believes in grace.
I'm the only man left in my house.
Yeah, I'm the
okay, that makes sense.
Dandy, no one cares.
But Roland, you missed
what?
He says, "I'm the last man standing in my house."
Yes,
he's the only man.
You
standing
are.
In his house.
No wonder you think no.
It's not going to happen that way, Roland.
No, it won't.
No. So,
how do we know that? There's a story we're going to take you through here for a minute. We're going to find this in Elijah. So guys, go to 1 Kings.
One Kings
1 Kings 18 and 19. I'm finding that is actually more accepted than I thought.
Yeah. I had no idea either. I mean, I was always first, second, third. That was the way you said it. That was the appropriate way. And
that's
apparently,
a dogmatic belief.
Oh, I see.
First Kings or Second Kings?
One Kings. Not first, One Kings.
Yeah.
Whatever.
I made fun of Trump for doing that, but yeah. Then I've met more and more people who actually say that.
Uh-huh.
And it actually makes sense, One Kings. I mean, literally, I mean, Tuck should like that.
Yeah.
Because Tuck, does that say first?
Or does it say one?
Or does it say one?
Depends upon your translation.
Or your dogmatic belief.
Or your dogmatic belief. It indicates the first.
Yes,
Doesn't indicate one. It indicates the first.
Okay, but doesn't one indicate first? What comes first, the cart or the horse? Hmm.
Chicken or the egg.
We're not going down this road.
Well, that my argument there, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, what came first is Yahweh, and he could have created an egg that hatched, or he could have created a chicken which had eggs which hatched. I personally feel that he made a chicken.
Tuck says this with so much, there is a smile on his face. Okay, I want everyone to know as they listen to Tuck that he's actually smiling, and I love it! I think he does have to create the chicken first, because he has to, I mean, we know from creation that he made these animals, and then the animals came
Adam and Eve, he created Adam, he created Eve. Then we created babies.
So,
the babies.
But I mean, Adam could not have named a chicken if he was still in an egg. I mean, he probably would have called that an egg.
He did.
Oh, he did.
No, he did not.
Okay, what did he do?
He called it whatever it would have been called, translated into egg eventually.
Yeah.
Okay. Squirrel.
Squirrel. Okay, we've had enough of that. We're in 1 Kings or 1 Kings, however you want to say it, chapter 19. Okay? And this is when Elijah's running. Okay? Elijah has done a great feat in chapter 18. He has taken down the prophets of Baal. He did so because Yahweh showed himself, okay? He came down from the heavens and blew up an altar, which is pretty cool, with fire, and burned it all up. And then he gave power to Elijah to kill all the prophets of Baal. But then Jezebel, the queen, is pretty ticked off about this happening, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You killed all my prophets. So the word gets out to Elijah, and Elijah runs. In fact, in verse 3 it says, "And he was afraid and arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. And he left his servant there." All right.
So he leaves his servant there, and he goes and hides in a cave. All right? Well, maybe not even that. Let's read it so I don't mess this up. So Elijah goes on a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree.
Interesting. Month of the oak tree.
Oak tree? Yeah. I think you're probably right. And he requested for himself that he might die.
Wow. Okay.
Have you ever been there?
Well, yes.
It is enough now. And he says this in his prayer. It is enough now, O Lord, take my life, for I am not better than my fathers. And he lays down and slept under the tree. And behold, there was an angel touching him and said to him, arise and eat. Uh-oh. Here comes another interaction with a heavenly being or the spiritual realm. Okay?
Okay.
Just like we had read about a spiritual realm with Paul in the prison. All these guys are always asleep. You ever notice that? You're asleep.
They're slackers. That's what I'm saying.
And an angel comes in and shakes them up. Hey, wake up! Guy, I felt like this many times. I'm done. Just let me die. Let me go away.
Yeah.
Verse 6. Then he looked, and behold, and there was at his head a bread cake baked on hot stones in a jar of water.
Well, where did that come from?
Room service. Cave service.
Where else were bread cakes made, and from what food source in the Torah?
This is a manna cake.
At the store where they're made.
Buy
it from the store.
This is a manna cake. I think it's a manna cake straight from heaven. Okay. And a jar of water. So he drank and he laid down again. And the angel Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, hey, rise and eat because the journey is too great for you. So he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to the mountain of God. You think there's some energy in heavenly food?
Apparently.
Unbelievable. Then he comes to a cave and lodges there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him and said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah?
I don't know. I was told to come here.
I love this. And he said, Elijah said this, I have been very zealous. So here we go again. For the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, torn down thine altars, and killed thy prophets with the sword. And I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. I mean, you ever felt like that? I mean, you're zealous, and then you do all these things, and you think you're doing them for the Lord. Who else was zealous in Scripture in the New Testament? And he did the wrong way. And he had to be knocked off his donkey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Saul.
Yes.
Saul thought he was right. He thought he was doing the work of the Lord, but he missed the heart of the command.
Right.
And so
because he knew it. He knew the New Testament was the way to. Oh wait, no, he didn't. He didn't know the New Testament. he knew the Torah, you know, better than most.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that the Pharisees and Sadducees all thought that the Messiah and the followers of Messiah were following the magic of Hasatan.
Mm-hmm.
They all thought that. In fact, Jesus responds to them many times, three times, saying to them, how can a kingdom be divided against itself? Can mm-hmm. Satan take out Satan? No.
Yeah.
So start listening to me. I'm not black magic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm coming to you, and I'm doing the works of Messiah. I am doing the works of heaven, or Yahweh.
What they did wrong
is
they misinterpreted. And that's why Yeshua came and started preaching opposite of what they were preaching. So they misinterpreted Scripture and were speaking lies, whether it was willing or just accidental, but that's what they were preaching against Yeshua.
It's funny how that happens.
Yeah.
But that usually happens over dogmatic beliefs that are not checked in the spiritual realm, as we found out in Ephesians. If we're in prayer, if we understand God's laws over man's, I think we can make that definition. So he says this to him, verse 11. Go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. What does that mean? Go and pray? Or go and... What does that mean to you, Aaron?
Well,
Tuck?
What's it say? It says, go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord.
Before means to come and worship him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but what does it say? It says, go and stand. Don't say to do anything. It just stand before him. Wait for him.
Judgment?
There's no
word?
There's no telling. You wait.
Okay.
He'll inform you whatever it is that he wants from you. And I want you to do is you stand and wait.
I love that. Maybe shut up and listen?
It's kind of like that.
Do it better from Tuck's point of view.
Most of us don't do that too well.
And behold, the Lord was passing by.
So he was told to go in this very particular spot. Be here. And the Lord passed by that spot.
I mean, we read through these things kind of quick, but it's amazing. And a great and strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord.
So when he passes by, this...
There's a tornado.
Thanks for putting it that way. But Yahweh was not in the wind.
Ooh.
And after the wind, an earthquake. But Yahweh was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but Yahweh was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of a gentle blowing. And it came about when Elijah heard it, that he wrapped his face in his what, Tuck?
Mantle. His cloak.
Mm.
Oh, my word. If you guys have been paying attention to this from the beginning of today, Isaiah 59:17, how we go into Ephesians 6, and how we also start to understand this thing about mantle. What is that mantle? All right. And he went out and stood at the entrance of the cave, and behold, a voice came to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? It's the second time.
Yeah.
And he repeats himself. Elijah says, I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, torn down thine altars, and killed thy prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away.
They're going to go run and hide.
But Yahweh said to him, go return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Syria, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel Meholah, and you shall anoint a prophet in your place.
What's the mess? What's the picture of that?
He has great place. Yahweh is using him to carry out his plan.
Look what he says further in 18. This is after he anoints him. And in verse 18, he says, yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed in Baal and every mouth that has not kissed him. Wow. And so let's go back. He tells him that he's going to put someone in his place. So let's go to verse 17. And it shall come about, the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall put to death. And the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall put to death. He's giving three people that are going to be doing the works that Elijah did.
Yeah.
Okay, now remember, the sword of truth, we're to fight spiritual battles with the sword of truth in Ephesians that we found Paul talking about. But yet here we are, both in the physical and the spiritual, for people who worshipped another god.
Mm-hmm.
And these three people will be zealous, like Elijah, to take the sword against those who do not follow. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him.
What does that say? Is there 7,000 only left that worship? Or is there 7,000 people who do the works of you, Elijah? That's a hard verse.
Yeah. Yeah, because it could kind of go either way there, it seems.
Yeah, to know for certain, and I don't even know if that's correct, but it would seem that we would need to go back to the Hebrew to see exactly how it's stated.
How it's stated.
You know, because according to the English translation, yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel. So that's part of that's the key right there. I have left me 7,000 in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't say about anywhere else in the world.
No.
You know, and so maybe there was only one more. Maybe there was 7 million more in the rest of the world. I don't know. But that just depends on, I mean, Yahweh is specific. And we assume too many things when we read specific things. We don't go back to the source. In this particular case, going back to the Hebrew and see exactly what it says, what the translation comes across as. And so it may be just as simple as 7,000 in Israel. But
what about before this time? You know, when I looked at this text before, I was, you know, I kind of started to relate with Elijah. Elijah said two times that he's been zealous.
Right.
And yet he's going to lose his life. And then Yahweh says to him, well, you're going to anoint other people and they're going to take your place. So here's three. Okay.
Yeah.
Is that condemnation or is that rest and relaxation for Elijah? Now, we know that Elijah is eventually taken up into the heavenlies.
Mm-hmm. Which he doesn't know at this point.
No, he doesn't. Is it okay to just tell the Lord, I'm tired and I'm done?
Well, yes. I mean,
I'm wondering about that.
I think it is, as long as you can follow it up with, but your will. You know, if I'm done, I'm tired. But use me if I need to be used still.
Yeah.
But he didn't say that. He just said, I've been zealous. I've done all these things. They're seeking my life. He's crying out with this passion of feelings of inadequacy, feelings of, you know,
fatigue, tiredness. Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Well, it's human. Yeah. Okay is not the right word to use in that particular case.
Right.
Because according to Yahweh's will, I don't think it is okay, but he wants people who are striving continually in spirit and in truth. And so Elijah had, he was a warrior, yet when it came, push came to shove, he just won a huge battle against Baal. And then Jezebel growls at him and he freaks, he runs.
But here's, you know? But here's the thing. Who does he call out to? He didn't call out to his buddy and say, oh, God, I'm just so mad at him right now because he's got me. I'm just worn out. I can't do it. No, he goes to him and says, I'm done, God. I just can't do anymore here. He's calling out for help. And so then Yahweh says to him, I've got a plan. I got these three guys lined up for you right behind you.
I like that because he asked him twice, what are you doing here? Okay. And also the angel comes to him and refuels him, you know, but then he's asked, you know, what are you doing? And that quiet voice eventually comes to him and he wraps himself in this cloak. That's a wonderful picture. There's another person in scripture that gets tired. Moses is one of them. He always says, you know, God, you deal with these people. I'm done.
And once again, it's instead of he doesn't go to Aaron and say, I'm done with these people. I'm going to walk off into the end of the desert here and just leave them here.
Yeah.
No, he calls to Yahweh. He says, I'm done. I can't do this.
So if your zeal is taken down, what do you find? Zeal is usually about this passionate approach. So notice the wind, the fire, it wasn't there anymore, but Yahweh meets Elijah on terms of quietness and then speaks to him quietly. I wonder if that refreshing is needed for many of us that get zealous. You know, we've looked at the purpose of being zealous is to bring people back to Yahweh. That's the purpose. But sometimes a person gets tired and says,
well, we're doing his work. And we're not designed to do his work.
Yeah.
Not in his fashion. We're humans. He's not. And so, granted, he may inspire you. He may fill you with super strength for a time, but you will become fatigued because you are human. Until that changes, you know, and Yahweh gives us, manifests for us a body that is, you know, enduring and is everlasting, we'll always come to that point to where we're fatigued and we need the rest. We need to go to sleep, so to speak.
Elijah sleeps twice.
Yeah.
He's been running. He's been running in front of chariots. I mean, think about what he did. He wiped out hundreds of prophets. He runs in front of Ahab's chariot over a great distance. He's now feared with fear because fear. He's filled with fear from Jezebel.
He's feared with Phil.
Did I just say that? Yeah. His body must be just overcome.
We can only imagine. I mean, because it appears to where all he did was pray. What's so physically demanding about prayer? But as we all know, that can be pretty, very physically demanding.
Yeah.
You know, the office of prayer.
And you ever notice that Aaron has brought it up, is that he just got done doing great things and then he's hit.
Right.
How many times has that happened to us? You get into a spirit moment, you get hit with great things, and you know your life is really, you see your purpose, you see the purpose of zealousness, and then you're hit with accusations, or you're hit with doubt, or you're hit with fear.
Maybe, I don't know this because it doesn't say it specifically, but maybe pride has something to do with this.
Hmm.
Elijah came into a particular place right after he had done great things. All right, who recognized the fact that he had done great things? He did. You know, was he patting himself on the back, so to speak? Was he, you know, being prideful about
but
that?
But he didn't say that. He just said,
oh, I know it
did. I've been zealous. Yeah. Zealous means I've been passionate for you.
Right.
So,
I'm just
saying.
The darkness must flee from the living word. His light now.